Hello and welcome to the first Dialect of 2017. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Nick Connor. Are you a tenant or a licensee? We speak to Nick Connor, who, along with Greg Roynan, is taking Bristol City Council and Camelot to court. These are old people's homes that were given up by the council about 3 or 4 years ago, but they're living in them in appalling conditions. Also, Tony Sheldon. He's a British journalist working in Holland, and he's just published a book in Dutch translated as In the Terror of the Night, and it's the civilian story of the Battle of Arnhem, Operation Market Garden, in September 1944. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. That's 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
My name's Nick Connor. I'm with a property guardian scheme, have been for about 4 years. It's a company called Camelot that operate this system. It's essentially what to do with certain empty buildings while they're being decided whether to be knocked down or put to another use. But in the meantime, they put people up who pay rent, a bit less than normal, but they pay rent and they stay there, and it's a sort of short term. But it's a housing thing.
I mean, what was your situation when you first took one of a place with Camelot?
I'd been renting a private house, and it was a shared house, and the other people moved out, and all of a sudden I was looking at paying all of the rent, or I looked around and I Googled cheap places to rent. And that was in the Bath area, and I came across Camelot, this company, and went with them.
So Camelot have a deal, and the property that you're in at the moment is actually owned by the City Council. How does that work?
Well, this one, yeah, it's Bristol City Council own it, and it used to be an elderly person's home, and it became empty for whatever reason about 3 years ago.
Well, I'll tell you what the reason was. It's because the City Council decided we're not going to care for elderly people in homes anymore. We're going to bring in some kind of private home care service who will go out to visit them at their homes. That is assuming they've got a home, and for a lot of the elderly people who were in the council care homes at the time, hundreds of them were very worried, where are we going to go? The council's going to close our home. So there was a lot of trauma went on there about 3 or 4 years ago. And so what you're telling me is that that home is still there, so you're living in there still at some sort of reduced rent.
Yeah, it's been there for 3 years. There have been up to 21 people, but that sort of number living there. Cheaper than normal, cheaper than market value rent.
Okay, yeah. So let's have a figure, because, you know, accommodation in Bristol, we're talking quite often even up to £200 a week, that sort of price, you know, £300 even in some places.
Yeah, well, my rent has been £300 a month.
Right, so you're paying maybe half or a quarter of what other people are paying. What's the standard of the accommodation?
It's pretty grim, to be honest. There's the central heating was turned off and the hot water a couple of months after I moved in.
So is it like in the winter, literally freezing cold in there?
Yeah, it's freezing cold. It's someone coined a phrase to me, said, oh, you're in one of those places where you pay to squat. So the conditions are similar to squatting, but we're paying rent for these places.
Okay, and do you have to then pay your own electricity individually, or is it sort of some sort of collective scheme?
No, they itemise in my licence agreement, they itemise the rent, which is called a fee, and council tax that I pay, and utilities. So it's an all-in figure.
See, you know, this immediately sounds to me dodgy. So they're talking about a fee, not rent, and they're also talking about a licence, not a tenancy.
This is the point, is that we're granted a licence rather than a tenancy, and all a licence is legally is permission to be there. So they've got no obligation. All the usual housing regs that you're protected if you're a tenant don't apply to a licence holder.
So why don't all landlords do this? Then they can chuck people out any time they feel like it.
Well, they have to give us 28 days notice as opposed to 2 months notice if you've got a tenancy. But they put this under the guise of being a short-term security solution. So basically, we'll put some people in, won't charge as much rent as normal, but the place won't get squatted or vandalised. So they disguise it as a short-term security solution. But clearly, 3 years I've been there, it's a housing thing.
How many people across the city do you think are being housed like this?
Well, I know of six other properties that are with Camelot, and there's another company, Ad Hoc, that is big. It's a guess, but I put it around the perhaps 200 mark.
So that's 200 people who aren't actually being properly housed through some sort of dodge. And this is a dodge which is admittedly at arm's length, actually been arranged and organised by the city council.
Well, ultimately, the owner of the property, so therefore the landlord, is the city council. This company, Camelot, technically, you could argue, they're just an agent of the landlord, who is the council.
So where have Camelot come from, and how old is the firm?
Camelot were formed basically in Holland, and it was a kind of, like a grown-up version of squatting. So they said, OK, well, instead of people just squatting, we'll give them permission, a licence, we'll charge them some money. So that's kind of where it was born about 15 years ago. It's moved over to the UK. Camelot have been here about 10 years.
I seem to remember some sort of anti-squatting company. So is that how they were set up in Holland to stop squatting? Saying, well, look, OK, we don't want squatters in here, but we don't want to do the place up. So we'll have a halfway house. We'll have people who are effectively squatting, but they're paying.
Like this guy that I met coined the phrase, so you're paying to squat, exactly that.
But Bristol City Council don't have to pay for this service at all, so they're obviously thinking it's quite a good deal. They're getting free security effectively.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're getting free security, and it's something they can kind of shelve that property and not worry about it, because in the meantime it's being taken care of as such.
I mean, you would have thought that they would want to either use these buildings for purposes like housing, maybe, maybe convert them to use for council housing or something, or else sell them. So why is neither happening?
I don't know the clear answer, but the place where I live now, ironically, it's going to be demolished and redeveloped for social housing. So the 20 or so people that have lived there for 3 years will be displaced in order to spend some money, a large amount of money, to create more social housing, which seems a bit odd, but that's what they've done. But it's taken them 3 years to get to the stage of what should we do with this place.
It does seem to me as if the council is really using Camelot as an excuse to almost a sort of cut out, you know, in intelligence parlance, so they don't have to actually take responsibility for the fact that they're not keeping places where people are living in their property up to scratch.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's an interesting point. Myself, being single, age 52, male, working, we're almost discriminated against. As a group, we're almost discriminated against. On the council website, on the housing list, it pretty much says, don't bother going on the list. By the time you're given somewhere, it'll be so far down the line, you'll be dead anyway. But exactly my group, 52, single, blah, 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 have been living there, up to about 20 people, 21 people, for years now. And so it's been a housing solution. We've not been looking for a private place or a council place in the meantime. And that's just the one property. Like I say, it could be as many as 200 over Bristol.
Okay, tell us about your property. Obviously, you've been there a while. You've got to know it quite well. How big is it and what's it like inside?
It's large. There are three floors. I'd guess, I've never counted them all, but I'd guess that it probably used to have about 40 or 50 old folk living there. Long corridors, rooms going off each corridor. There are some kind of, I don't know what they call, a lounge or whatever. Now, it's really grim. It's almost like living in a bit of a ghost town. And when I moved in, the stink you could imagine from, or stench from an old people's home, was rife. It's a semi-derelict, what was an old person's home, and we've kind of made the best we can.
I mean, have you actually spent time doing it up at all?
We try and make it comfortable, but when the heating's been turned off, and this company, Camelot, do as little maintenance as they possibly can, they even write us warning emails that we've left a light bulb left on overnight and we've got to keep the electric bill down. So as much as you can make it home, which it is, it's difficult under those circumstances.
And do they fine you for things like that? Have they got any kind of redress, or would they just threaten to evict you for leaving the light on?
They'll give you a warning, but quite often they'll just issue a fine. We've all been fined for general untidiness of the kitchen, a £35 fine times 20 people for somewhere that's untidy. And they remind us that they will terminate our tenancy if we don't pay that fine.
How untidy is the kitchen for everybody to be imposed a £35 fine? It must be pretty untidy.
No, I've lived in a house where three people share, and someone will go to work and there'll be breadcrumbs and there'll be stuff left in the kitchen from when they've done breakfast and rushed out, and there'll be your average regular kind of someone or people aren't really clearing up after themselves. No, it was not a disgrace by any count.
And are there other communal areas? Obviously there's corridors and things like that. Have you got like a communal sitting room, that sort of thing?
Yeah, there's a really large communal sitting room where, you know, we put some sofas in, the TV and stuff like that. In the winter, it's almost a no-go zone because it's so large and it's so freezing. So, yes, there are areas like that, but it doesn't lend itself to making it easily. You can't even warm the place up.
Now, it sounds to me there's thousands of people across the country living like this, and yet none of those people are really living in places which are up to the proper standard of any housing accommodation should be.
No, and there are certain standards. Where I live, it qualifies as a large house of multiple occupancy, and their regulations governed by BCC, who incidentally are the owners of the building, and it's mandatory for there to be a licence for a large HMO, which hasn't been in place for the 3 years.
You see, Bristol City Council are the licensing authority, and it's up to them to prosecute themselves or to actually enforce this themselves on themselves.
Exactly, via their agent Camelot. And neither, this is why it seems to me that the council and Camelot have been, to whatever degree, they've been in bed together because that licence wasn't enforced. Now, 3 years on, they've granted a licence, but only because we're kicking up a bit of a fuss. And exactly that, they're not enforcing their own regulations.
No, and what about things like basic things like environmental health?
Well, a lady a year and a half ago who lived there got in touch with the environmental health team to complain that the one and only hot water boiler that's left in the building working wasn't working. It got fixed, it worked for a few weeks, but then we all collectively got an email saying that can we remind you that you're not allowed to get in touch with the owner of the building, which is the council, and they reminded us they would terminate our tenancy if it happened again.
Ah, but hang on, you just said tenancy, it's a licence. It's ever so easy to confuse, isn't it? Because effectively you are tenants, and the council is, they started this, am I right in thinking this, under George Ferguson when he was mayor?
Yeah, that's right, that's when all these, there were quite a few elderly persons' homes that were closed down, but yes, it was at that
And
time.
Is it just the elderly people's homes that are being run by Camelot like this, or are there other council properties that are empty too?
All I know of are the elderly persons' homes. There are private properties as well that Camelot take on, right down to a house, you know. So, but no, all I know is that it's elderly persons' homes across Bristol.
I mean, how is it for you not knowing that you're going to be able to stay there as well? You've told me that your place is going to be demolished soon for housing. So, this is a horrible situation to be in where you... In a month's time, you know, after Christmas, you might be in the situation where you've got nowhere to live.
Well, you see, that's fine, because I went into the agreement with my eyes open. It's cheaper rent as such, although they won't call it rent, they call it a licence fee.
I don't agree with you. I'm going to interrupt you here, because I don't agree with you it's cheaper. What you're getting for your money is about right, because you're not getting proper accommodation. You're getting, basically, you're being stuck in a kind of warehouse, a cold warehouse.
Yeah, in hindsight now, that's exactly what happens. But when I went into the agreement, it's a bit cheaper, but it is short term. the place could get knocked down at some point very soon. We'll only get 28 days notice. I was aware of that and I went to that, but in hindsight now, the conditions that, so yeah, it's not, if you buy an old car, it's going to break down. You pay cheap rent, it's pretty
so
rubbish.
I hope you've managed to save up a lot from your job, more than you would have done if you'd had to take private accommodation, have you?
Who does?
No.
You spend what's left over
of
your wages.
Well, also, of course, quite often, jobs don't pay hardly enough for the rent and the electricity and that sort of thing nowadays.
Well, I'm lucky because I'm working. A lot of people are just doing a part-time job and they're forced to move into somewhere that seems cheaper. Well, it is cheaper in pound notes, but a lot of people don't have any spare money. That is all they can afford. And they are more than scared about rocking the boat and being thrown out.
Sounds awful. Anyway, there is some action taking place in the county court, isn't there, in January, with you, Nick, and also a guy called Greg Roynan. What's that all about?
That's essentially, we're contesting the fact that although we signed a licence agreement before we moved into these places, what we're saying, the way that we've lived, which is having our own room with a lock on it, there are all sorts of details, but we're essentially saying that what's transpired over time is effectively that we have been tenants of Camelot as opposed to licence agreement holders.
So what's the difference in law between a licence and a tenancy?
Well, if you've got a licence, believe it or not, animals have more protection generally than ourselves. We are merely given permission to be there as licence holders. So a lot of the housing laws, housing regulations don't come into effect if you've just got a licence. If you've got a tenancy, which can be short term, you can have a 1 month tenancy. It doesn't mean, oh great, they can't kick me out for at least 6 months. If you've got a tenancy, whether it's month by month, you are protected by more of the housing laws that you just aren't protected by. And we're just talking about heating, hot water, simple things. I've reported electric shocks when using a shower. Well, you have protection and some comeback if you're a tenant, if they don't fix it. In our case, they don't fix it, full stop. So it's essentially that you have some basic protection by housing law if you're a tenant, but not if you're a licensed agreement.
Are Camelot the worst landlords in the world? Or the country, at least?
I've done a lot of reading and research lately, obviously because of what's going on. In my opinion, they are the worst. They are the market leader, and I'd say they are the worst.
Okay, Nick, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
That was Nick Connor. There's a court case apparently on the 12th of January with Greg Roynan, another one of these guardians. Are they tenants or licensees?
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Tony Sheldon, and I'm a British journalist working and living in the Netherlands. And I originally went in 93. Something like 10 years later, 2004, the 60th anniversary of the Battle of Arnhem, I came across a story about a local general practitioner in Arnhem who was shot by the Nazis, partly for helping British soldiers. His name was Jan Zwolle, and he's still commemorated in the Bakkerstraat in Arnhem. There's a plaque with names of five people who were shot with him. So I then wrote an article for the British Medical Journal, who I work for, about what happened to this general practitioner, and went along to the commemoration and was able to talk to people who had been there at the time, eyewitnesses, who had been teenagers and young adults at the time, and saw what happened and could tell me about their own experiences. One in particular, Vil van Koldenhoven. I interviewed her for a couple of hours because her father was one of five who was shot with the doctor. And she explained that there are others like her who were eyewitnesses to, civilian eyewitnesses to the Second World War Battle of Arnhem, who wished to tell their story. Many hadn't told them before either. Post-war, people just got on with their life and didn't talk about it. Many have been involved for years in the commemorations to welcome veterans and their families, British veterans from the airborne forces to Arnhem, but have never talked about their own experiences. And I always felt as a journalist that there was a story under the story which hadn't actually been told. Ville put me in contact with other people who were civilian eyewitnesses to the battle. And over a period of 10 years, I gathered together, speaking in a native Dutch, about 100 interviews. With that, I was able to also read Dutch diaries. And there's a large number of diaries in the Dutch Institute for War Documentation and also the Gelderland Archive and the Airborne Museum. So there's a huge amount of material there. And what I was able to do is sifting through it is... I realised after a couple of years, really, I had enough material to actually write a daily history, a civilian's history of the Battle of Arnhem. And actually everything fitted together. I had enough eyewitness accounts of what happened when the airborne landed on the Sunday, what happened when they advanced into Arnhem on the Monday, what happened when they were forced back to the Oosterbeek perimeter on the Tuesday. And virtually every hour, there was another incident which was recounted by an eyewitness.
Yeah, because I think it's one of those battles which is a bit of a can of worms over the years, and it's attracted a lot of attention from military historians. What did you find out from the civilians about the progress of the battle?
The chaos and the fact that nobody knew what was going to happen from one moment to the next. The civilians didn't. The airborne didn't. Nobody knew if A Street was German. This is in Oosterbeek or in the outskirts of Arnhem, or was held by the airborne. People had to react very, very quickly. In particular, from the civilian's point of view, was how there was this makeshift medical services set up for the airborne, mostly the airborne wounded, although also for Dutch civilians and indeed for Germans wounded as well. There was individual homes, such as the Kate de Horst home and others, became dressing stations. But also there's a particular hotel in the middle of Oosterbeek, Hotel Tafelberg, which was set up by a local GP, Dr. Van Manen, Gerrit Van Manen, as an emergency field hospital in the event of the outbreak of war, which hadn't been used up to that date and was set up originally to look after civilian casualties. But on the second day, the British arrived and were able to just walk straight into a makeshift hospital, which the Dutch civilians had set up with bedding and clothes and food and so forth. The airborne then took over most of this hotel as a field dressing station, but there was a large contingent of Dutch civilians, up to 30, some qualified, some just helpers, who cared for the wounded, British, Dutch, Polish, and German alike. And without their efforts, then there are a lot of airborne soldiers, a lot of people from the British paratroopers who wouldn't be alive, who wouldn't have survived the battle. What I learned was that the Dutch civilians played a role. It wasn't an organised role in advance. It wasn't sort of necessarily the underground. Some were in the underground. Others were just turned up and did their best. But people reacted. People were happy to have their homes and their cellars turned into emergency field hospitals for the soldiers.
There were some peculiar incidents to do with the battle. For example, the fact that the Nijmegen Bridge, which was supposed to have been blown up by the Germans to stop the British advance, didn't get blown up. And also the presence of SS units apparently just resting in the area by coincidence. I wonder if what the civilians have told you can throw any light on incidents like that.
Well, firstly, my book is about civilians. It's not about the military. The military aspect has been picked over by hundreds of books over the last 60, 70 years. So I couldn't possibly...
For example, the underground. Were they active? Yeah. Because there were some people who have said, actually, a lot of the underground were betrayed before the battle.
No, the underground were active. Piet van Arnhem, had a group actually within the town of Arnhem. There was an active underground group within the St. Elizabeth Gasthaus, the St. Elizabeth Hospital, which was able to get injured paratroopers, including General Hackett, smuggle him out after the battle. So they were able to, the underground were able to play a role in helping the injured airborne troops. As far as the actual battle itself goes, there was a call for volunteers in Oosterbeek on the Monday with the Oranje Battalion, and there's something like 30 or so young men just put orange armbands and were given old Lee Enfield rifles and were used as scouts, and they were used to collect supplies that had been dropped by parachute. After 2 days, the British said, "This is too dangerous. If we get overrun, you'll get shot." And they were disbanded, and they then left and took off their orange armbands and went to the Tafelberg and went to the Hotel Schronord and helped people, helped in the medical aspects of it. The Dutch were very, very aware of the presence of German troops. They were very aware that General Model, the SS commander, was actually in the Tafelberg. That was his headquarters, and he left before the Dutch arrived to set up the hospital. They were aware of the build-up of armour and etc. Now, why this information wasn't brought out was partly because the British, the underground, the resistance in the Netherlands had been infiltrated a year or two earlier with the Engelandspiel. They had infiltrated the underground, and British agents that were dropped into the Netherlands were murdered or turned. So there were big question marks about the reliability of the Dutch resistance. But in addition to that, there was also a certain arrogance on the part of the airborne. There wasn't a real effective way of engaging the Dutch resistance in helping them as they could have done as scouts in particular, and help tended to arrive by an individual say, "I can show you how to get from here to there without being killed by that machine gun going through this alleyway and down this back garden." So individual actions were able to help, but the British didn't coherently use the resistance to help in their efforts. I mean, this famous thing in Cornelius's Ryan's book, A Bridge Too Far, that the underground resistance group in Arnhem had spotted the SS Panzer divisions that were on rest and recuperation in Zutphen and also slightly north of Arnhem. Clearly, it's the evidence suggests that the information was got back to Britain about that. The British had that information, and it was a question of what value that the game gave to it. I think the matter is fairly academic. It's obvious that these Panzer divisions had been retreating from Normandy. They hadn't been destroyed. They were somewhere, and if they hadn't been Holland, they would have been Germany, and Germany is 20 miles away, and there's a perfectly effective rail line. So a lot of the armour that destroyed the 1st Airborne Division was brought in by train after the landing. So the fact is the British must have known, the Airborne Division must have known that they were likely to be attacked by armour one way or the other within a day or two of landing.
Well, so Colonel Frost says that he wasn't given any warning. But I mean, it was that it was there when they arrived. I mean, what's your thoughts, if you've got any, about whether the Germans did have some kind of warning that this parachute landing was about to happen?
No. The Germans weren't alerted to it. No, and they were absolutely caught napping. I have interviewed the daughter of Annie Caspers, who a nurse at the Tafelberg, and her mother explained how she went into the Tafelberg 2 hours after was he a field marshal? Model, anyway, had left, and his dinner was still sitting there, and a cigar stub was stubbed out, and there was important documents they tried to shred and didn't have the time to. The evidence from the people in Oosterbeek was the Germans were caught napping and they had to get out quick.
What about the tens of thousands of Dutch that died in the winter afterwards? Because that must have been pretty horrendous.
Yeah, I mean, the suffering of the German Dutch civilians continued, and of course, because the areas south of the Rhine were liberated, but north weren't, meant that fuel supplies, coal in Limburg, wood. Was now in short supply north of the Rhine, so heating was a huge problem. From the first day of the battle, Prince Bernhard ordered, as head of the Dutch interior forces, ordered the railway workers to go on strike, and they did. And in retaliation for that, the Germans prevented food supplies being moved around the country. The Dutch railway workers put down tools, and that was it. The railways didn't run. How effective it was, because I suppose they could have been run by Dutch Nazis or the Germans themselves. I don't know. The other thing, of course, is that with reasonable amount of air domination, there wasn't many trains that could actually pass into Holland at that point. The Dutch certainly paid a heavy price for it, because it meant that food supplies couldn't be transferred to the Randstad. That's the area, the built up area in the west part of the Netherlands: Amsterdam, Utrecht, The Hague, Rotterdam, Leiden, Haarlem, and that's where the majority of the population was. And there's some interesting statistics about the so many millions of people were eating so many calories. I can't remember them offhand, but it was grim, and thousands of people died in the Hunger Winter. It was okay if you lived in farms in the north and the east, because you'd have food, but if you lived in this particular bit on the west coast, then you were in trouble. The Dutch suffered because of hunger. The Dutch suffered because the refugee columns out of Arnhem and Gelderland were strafed by the RAF, bombed and strafed. And I have horrible accounts from civilians of this arbitrary nature of these attacks, and they'd be going along. And
so you're saying that this is refugee columns. Why were the RAF attacking them?
Well, basically, the RAF and the Allied air forces were attacking anything that moved. Now, the roads were congested, whether out of necessity or because of using human shields. German military transport was mixed up with the refugees on the roads.
I'm just thinking, if I was a refugee on the road, if possible, I'd stay well away from any German units.
Yes, they tried to do so, but unfortunately, it was not always possible. You need to ask an expert on the RAF from that point. What I would say is I have many accounts in my books of people being machine gunned and butchered on the road out of Arnhem. And the thing is that if you ask the Dutch, they refuse to blame the Allies or the RAF. It was always because, oh, well, there was a German soldier there. But they did suffer. They suffered from deaths in the evacuation. Of course, the evacuation was forced by the Germans. They had the whole of Arnhem, Oosterbeek, Renkum, the towns along the north coast of the Rhine were deemed to be a war zone, and everybody was forced to leave. Many Dutch defied that order and stay for as long as possible, but something like 150,000, if you take, depending on what area you take, were forced to flee north and west and to seek shelter wherever they could.
I just wonder if you could just point us to a couple of accounts in your book of the way that the civilians were treated by the Germans, either during or after the battle.
Well, there's a horrible occasion in I think it was Apeldoorn. A woman now in her 80s, I think. He would have been a teenager, but shopping with her mother. This was I think in the January 1945, and she was returning, and there was some seen an incident with crowds of people, and she saw a German soldier take a child and shoot it through the head.
Why?
She didn't hang around to ask. She describes how her mother said to her, "Let's just keep walking. Don't run. Don't run. If they run, they'll shoot you." Walked and walked and walked. I went around the corner, and then they ran as fast as they could. Life was cheap in occupied Holland. For instance, one of the there was a resistance attack on a man I think called Rauter. Again, I'm not absolutely. This is off the top of my head. This was about a week or two after the end of Market Garden, and in retaliation for that, I think sometime in November, German troops surrounded the Dutch town of Putter one night, and they rounded everybody up. They rounded all the women and children into a church, and all the men were separated. This wasn't like it occurred in Czechoslovakia, where then the church was set fire to, but all the men the Putter was then torched. All the men were sent off to work camps in Germany, and all the women and children were sent off. Of the men who were sent to work camps in Germany, I think 10% returned. So it was pretty much a death sentence. How else? There was a poor chap who was half Jewish, who Charles Moses, who he was medically trained, and as soon as the airborne landed, like so many people, he took to the streets and started celebrating and came out of hiding. And after the battle, even though the Germans had returned, he still kept his Red Cross armband and still offered medical help to people who were evacuees. And of course, he was eventually spotted by somebody and taken and tortured. Charles Moses was tortured and then shot, and what I was told about is that his mum couldn't recognise his corpse.
The parachute descent on Arnhem is one of those kind of unique things in history. It's one of the biggest, I think, of all time airborne assaults. Do the people that you've interviewed, do you recall them describing what it was like to see these people raining down from the sky?
Yes, yeah. And again, that's in countless books. The colours, they remember the fact that in Gelderland on Sunday, the 17th of September, 1944, was a beautiful late summer's day, beautiful blue skies. That there was first the bombing of Arnhem and of Orphaser psychiatric unit and other civilian areas. So people were first in their shelters or helping with the people who died and the injured. Then straight after that, or soon after that, came more planes. Obviously, they felt they were going to be bombed again. And then, but rather than being bombed, suddenly these parachutes started dropping out in these containers. And they talk about the colours. Different containers contain different colours of red parachutes with ammunition. And the sound of the Dakotas is something that people are still moved about now. And people talk to their roofs, and there's a famous photograph in the Cornelius Ryman book of people sitting or standing on a roof waving as a plane came over. This was the biggest airborne assault in history, and it happened over their heads. There was this incredible mixture of emotions. The number of civilians that died in the initial bombing was quite high. Something like 100, I think, that died beforehand.
Basically, the bombing was there to, I suppose, to soften up the
military barracks, anti-aircraft emplacements. But what happened is there was a 13-year-old girl. Was she 13 or was she 11? It was her birthday, and she was celebrating her birthday. And their house was next door to the a military barracks in Arnhem, and basically I think that she was beheaded by shrapnel. Her mother, they heard the bombs falling. Her mother took her hand and rushed her into the kitchen and pushed her in a cupboard under the stairs, meaning she would be safe. And a bomb came through the kitchen roof, which was outside the back of the house, exploded, and she was killed instantly. There was a family in an air raid shelter next in Leuven, south of the Rhine, which was near an anti-aircraft emplacement. And something like 12 members of the same family died. The whole lot went. So the butcher's bill of deaths, of civilian deaths, was quite high. And of course, the Warfaser psychiatric unit, the patients were outside in the sun, enjoying the sunshine, having their lunch when it was heavily bombed by fragmentation bombs. The written accounts of the bombing of Wolfhaver Psychiatric Hospital are fairly grim. So in some cases, there was a lot of psychosis prior to the bombing. The mental problems protected people. In other ways, of course, it made things a lot worse. But a lovely image of one patient who, despite their mental problems, cared for her injured helper, her injured medical staff, who'd been had a leg sliced off or something, and the patient looked after the former nurse. So the point you said, do they remember? They remember the butchery, they remember the explosions, and then straight afterwards, suddenly there was that they had been liberated. So incredible shift of emotions.
Then again, the liberation, but then again the realisation that actually it was a failure and that the Germans were back.
Yeah, and the realisation that Germans were back took a while. Nobody really believed that the Germans would prevail until they did. And there's a bit in the Cornelius Ryan book where I think it's Klaus or Voskol in Oosterbeek was asked, "We will win," and they replied, "No, they won't." And it's a famous quote in the Bridge Too Far film. Most people were convinced that one way or another that Monty would arrive, that his tanks would get through. And certainly in Oosterbeek and around the perimeter in Oosterbeek, people were genuinely shocked when they woke up on Tuesday morning, and it was absolute silence. And then in distance, the sound of tanks as the Germans moved in. The Dutch were bitterly disappointed, and there's little things like they were some people were threatened, they were dragged out of cellars, and there might be a shell shocked soldier in the cellar or an injured soldier, and they were made to stand and lectured and so forth. There weren't that many atrocities. The German armed forces didn't actually take revenge on the civilian population who they knew had helped one way or another. The airborne's as one might have expected. It was just not very nice. It was just rather unpleasant. And when Chap was saying it, we were dragged out of our cellar, there was something like a penknife on the floor, and one German soldier picked it up and said, "Oh, well, we don't need this here. You'll probably need it." Gave it back to the family, and then that next German soldier came in and said, "No, he won't. That's ours," and took it back. And the chap said, "Yes, my father said, we knew we were back where we started." There was a chap who helped out at the Schoonor dressing station, John Tuvater. He, as one of the diaries pointed out, really hated the Germans because he was a young man that endured 5 years of occupation and powerlessness. And He went up to the British and who were the British medical staff there, and said, "Look, I'm not going to take this. I'm going to try and escape south across the river and join the British army." And he had to be talked out of it by the medical staff, and they said, "Look, you know, the you will not get across the river now. You would be endangering your life." Yeah, my book is about the price that civilians paid. Of course, the other thing, which as it enters the book, is ammunition that's left over. The last Dutch civilian to die from treading on unexploded munitions was, I believe, 1956. A couple of years ago, a child brought a Mills hand grenade into school one day because there's a building site next to the school, and he just picked it up and said to his teacher, "Do you know what this is?" And the teacher said, "Well, put it down and let's get out, and we'll call the police." Famously, Jan de Horst's son, Piek, died. She had one of her sons died 2 years after the end of the battle, jumping out of a tree onto an anti-tank mine. And one of the most chilling episodes, really, of my book is I follow a family through the battle and how they took refuge, were forced out, how they survived the battle, survived the evacuation, survived the Hong of Inter, came back, and it was June 1946, and it was beautiful hot weather, and but it was very dangerous out on the streets. There was munitions everywhere. And this mother had three young daughters, aged four, I think five and seven. And they kept on saying, "Mummy, can't we go and play? Can't we go outside and play?" And eventually the mother said, "Okay, yes, you go out and play, but be careful, don't touch anything." And the three girls walked out of their house, walked down the street, and then one of them saw something on the street, which just out of curiosity bent down and touched it, and I think the eldest is when I interviewed said, "Next thing I knew was everything was black, and my leg was hanging off, and my mother was crying." I think one of the daughters had a tiny little nick on her neck, nothing. She had lost a leg below the knee, and the third sister, there was nothing left of her.
One of the things you mentioned was that for some people living in the area, they didn't really talk about the battle for a long time. Why do you think it's been such a long time before people are prepared to say, "Well, actually, I've got a few stories to tell about what happened 60, 70 years ago"?
I think the main thing is the stories are terribly sad, and it's about how they suffered. And they do not in any way want the British to feel any sense of guilt about what happened. They, in a way, it's strange that I, as an Englishman, I have to write this story, and I don't think that emotionally the Dutch were ready to write it, because they would have felt that anything, any description of their own suffering would have been implied criticism of the British. And it's in many ways very strange. They absolutely bloody love us. They think we're brilliant. And many veterans and many paratroopers can't understand it. And you have time and time again, you have these conversations where the para will say, "You know, but you know, we, why do you welcome us back? We came here, we lost, we result in your house being burnt down, your children being killed, you're being evacuated from your homes for the winter. You know, we thought you wouldn't be very pleased to see us." And everybody says, "Well, no, we saw how you fought, and we saw that you did your best for our freedom. You know, we thank you for that." And that's more important. But that's the one thing, is that they weren't going to really say it. And if there's going to be any civilian history, it's going to be rather sanitised. The other thing, I think, is that psychologically, especially in those days, you just got over it. Post-war, you got on with it. And I often say to people, didn't your parents write down what happened to them or tell you about them? I said, no. You know, I didn't know anything until 20 years later when my mother was admitted to a psychiatric unit. And then, you know, it all began to come out, that what she'd seen and what she'd suffered. There was a guy interviewed, a marvellous guy, an unsung hero, who was a 13-year-old, helped in a field hospital of a large country house, the Denenord, and after the battle helped bury something like, you know, a dozen or so British paras in the back garden. And it was something like 20 or 30 years later, he was driving along in the car and saw a shoe buzz side of the road. And he remembers during the Battle of Arnhem seeing a shoe with a leg, part of a leg in it. And it triggered off his post-traumatic stress disorder, for which he's suffered ever since. So there was a sense of, you know, yeah, you've got to get on with it, and you've got to stiff upper lip and push it back and just carry on. That's why I think that this story hasn't really been told. There's been bits and pieces that have come out in individual diaries and the Kate DeHorse story. But what I wanted to do in my book was to take the sort of style of military history, like Martin Middlebrook does, of eyewitness accounts of soldiers, and say, well, let's have eyewitness accounts of civilians. Arnhem, fairly rarely in Second World War battles, Stalingrad and Conn were also the same. Civilians were actually trapped very much within the fighting, and so they did have a front row seat in this horrible battle, and they have a story to tell. And so what I was able to do was to piece together all the individual little stories to make a coherent narrative of the Battle of Arnhem through the eyes of the Dutch civilians. And I don't try and really come up with any great revelation about what happened to the battle or what didn't. Perhaps if anything, the message is to say to the British reader, you know, look what the Dutch actually did for you and did for your countrymen, because it was a hell of a lot. It might not have been an organised underground movement. It was that some woman now in her 90s, during a battle under fire, a battle between the British Airborne and the SS Panzer divisions, had the temerity to get a wheelbarrow out of the garden shed, carry a wounded officer into the wheelbarrow, and then wheel him back half a mile to a dressing station where his life may or may not have been saved.
Just remind us of the title, because it's a pity it's not available in English, so if you can give us a Dutch and English title.
Yeah. The book is called De Verschrikking van de Nacht, or The Terror of the Night, and it is a quote from the famous psalm in the Bible, I think it's 92, which was, Thou shalt not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day. A psalm which was, according to the diaries, was repeated in trenches and cellars and things in the during the Battle of Arnhem. The Terror of the Night, in English, will be the translation to it. The idea was and still is being hawked around British literary agents, and I'm told there's no market for it in the UK. I went to the Netherlands. I went to an agency, and they got it published straight away, translated into Dutch, and it's, you know, since its publication February of last year, it's sold about 1,500 copies, which is a reasonable amount for a book of this nature. But most of all for me is that I've given talks, and I've had people come to me afterwards in tears, saying, thank you, because you gave me back my father. I never knew what happened to him, and now I know, and he never talked about it.
That's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our guest, Nick Connor, who was a guardian in an old people's home, a former old people's home, owned by Bristol City Council, in court on the 12th of January. Also, you just heard there from Tony Sheldon. He's a British journalist living in Holland who's written a book in Dutch, In the Terror of the Night, and he hopes to be publishing it in English soon. It's all about Operation Market Garden, the civilian side of the Battle of Arnhem in September 1944, the attempt to liberate Holland. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko.
Dialex, a Bristol broadband co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. And if you want to volunteer, go to Volunteering Bristol. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. They've also got a phone number, which is 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.